Act, session number 30285.
John Dixon, Reel 12.
Yes.
So, at that stage, you're actually waiting for demobilisation. Have you requested to be demobilised from the Air Force at that stage?
Well, you didn't have to do that, of course. All that was required is you just waited for your demob papers to arrive and the date in which you would be discharged. It was as simple as that. There was no nothing else that was involved. So then it was a question of where they sent me, and because I'd come from Cardiff, they sent me to Cardiff to wait for demobilisation at the recruiting centre with other air crew also there. And they were interested in lads too. But the two pilots and the bomber command signaller, they were also waiting for demobilisation. They had just sent us, I suppose, some place to wait out our time. Although they were both fully operational aircrew. One had been in the Far East and had got himself an Air Force cross flying Dakotas on the supply route to Burma. The other had been in bomber command and so on. Anyway, we wasted out of time, and then I began to have second thoughts about what to do. And then anyway, that I was posted from there then. And I went to 45 Reserve Centre, which was Wolverhampton, where I became the assistant adjutant.
So what did that what does that involve then as an assistant adjutant? What are you doing in your day to day?
It was a reserve centre, in reserve command, of course, and we, as you probably know, were there to look after the flying interests of the pilots and navs and so on who belonged to the VR. So we had Ansons and Tiger Moths, and each weekend we would have our reservists arrive on the station to do their weekend flying. And my job was fairly routine.
And is it this at the stage where you've decided to stay in the Air Force?
I'm thinking about staying in now. I'm wondering about staying in. I hadn't quite made up my mind. I don't know whether they wanted me to stay in either. That was another factor.
Because I was wondering, was there a question for you? Because I'm assuming that, you know, you're going into roughly a peacetime phase with the RAF at that point, and the element of your choice, because you've been used to a very active kind of service, armed conflict type experience, and now you're going into the peacetime RAF in a sense, which you've never really had experience of. Is that something that you're trying to weigh up as to how it's going to go, or whether you're going to enjoy that?
Yeah, and the point was that I didn't really have a great deal of knowledge about the wider implications of what was going on in the RAF, and things were closing down rapidly as everything folded up, and the demob had been finished, and in fact ultimately this reserve centre was also closed down, not whilst I was there. But what happened, what followed on, and that I then asked, and I applied for a short service commission, and I was granted that. And then I thought, I don't know what they're going to do with me now. But then the next thing they did, they sent me to learn cryptography to come to Bassett in Wiltshire. I did a course there. And I was told I was going to be sent to Egypt, to the headquarters there. And so I finished the course there, and was promptly sent out to, I was preparing to go to Egypt when a posting notice came in, and they changed it to the Far East, to Singapore.
What did the cryptography course involve then? What were you actually learning on a cryptography course?
Well, basically, how to transmit and decipher classified messages that were encoded and encrypted, and to run because of my signal background, I suppose, to run the watches and so on, with the NCOs and things like that.
Was that obviously because of the experience you had? Was that relatively easy to pick up the kind of things that you had to?
Yes, it was relatively easy. But I had to acquire touch typing skills. Otherwise, you couldn't really do the job properly. Quite a laborious job. I hated it. I thought it was terrible. And although I had NCOs to do, I had to do jobs myself. And I think what was worse was it was watchkeeping. So it meant that all my social life now was finished in terms of that, because you could never tell when you were going to be on duty throughout the night or you were coming off and going to bed. So I hated it. And anyway, I was fortunate. When I got out to Singapore and started to do this job, I was struck down by dengue fever rather severely. And I spent a couple of weeks in hospital whilst they were trying to sort things out. And at the end of it, they posted me from Changi to Salita. And they posted me to Far East Flying Boat Wing, where I was going to be the wing adjutant. And I was a flight lieutenant then. And so then at last I got the job that I really wanted, because I could start flying again. And not only that, but I would fly with the CO and I could do what I wanted to do in the realms of my power as a wing adjutant.
So when are we looking at? When did you arrive there?
In 1953. In Singapore, 51. When the Malaysian fighting was on at the time. And our flying boats, we had three squadrons on the wing. And we were involved in doing a number of things, one of which was giving support to the bombing attacks in Malaysia and attacking the communists there. So I did some of that. And then we were also sending our squadrons, rotating them, to Iwakuni in Japan, where we were flying in the Korean War. And so that became interesting. And what was a bit of flying down in Malaysia and some flying up in Korea, things were back where they ought to be. And I was very content with the way things were going. And I liked my job, and I liked the flying, and it worked very well. And of course, the Korean War came to an end, and roughly when my tour in the Far East was to end. So that's exactly what happened, and then I was posted back to UK in December. I think I mentioned, didn't I, that I had in fact been originally posted in Singapore to Changi. That would of course be in March of 1951, but having spent a year in Changi, living in their headquarters, Malaya Mess, which was found on Changi Creek, which is where, if I may say, is where I seem to have collected the collection of mosquitoes that gave me the dengue fever and put me in hospital for a couple of weeks. I was subsequently posted, this time to Salita, which had been the base of our foreign flying boat wing, and still was, of course. And I found that I'd been posted to Salita as the wing adjutant of Far East Flying Boat Wing, which consisted of three squadrons, 88, 209, and 205. They were extremely busy, considering that the aircraft were relatively old, the type of sorties that the wing was doing was, believe it or not, ground attack type sorties against the Malaysian communists, and giving support, of course, to the army in their ground offensive role. Other type of sorties we flew reconnaissance type things as far as up to the Indochina East Coast, Vietnam, where we would look out for anything that was taking place there that might be providing arms for the communists in Malaysia, or Malaya as it then was, of course. Those were the regular sorties. But another interesting thing which came up in that time, of course, was the fact that the Korean War was in being, and the three squadrons were participating in the Korean War on a rotational basis. We sent one of our squadrons up there, and then of course they'd stay for several weeks and then come home, and we would rotate and send one of the other squadrons up to do the type work. And the work we were doing there was primarily, again, reconnaissance around the Korean coast and the straits there between Japan and Korea. Once again, on the lookout for anything suspicious, or where if we found units of the North Korean Navy up to some no good. So that the role there was primarily one of a general reconnaissance nature.
Yeah. What would the kind of duration of those reconnaissance missions be, really?
Well, I see that one of the sorties there was an anti-submarine and shipping surveillance patrol that was in the Tsushima Straits, and that lasted 8 hours and 15 minutes. And another subsequent sortie, a similar job, was 8 hours and 40 minutes. That was a general period. Again, 8 hours 50, again late on later sorties, and so on. The fire dog sorties, as we called them, on the ground attack in support of the army in Malaysia, was a persistent call on our services. And in a way, it's a strange thing that our gentle flying boat found itself as a ground attack aircraft in the later period of its life. They were old aircraft, and some of the Sunderlands that on the squadrons had perhaps done a lot of service, and their equipment tended to reflect that. Not that we had any serious serviceability problems. I also noticed that we put up a dozen Sunderlands over Singapore to praise the Queen on the first day. So the Singaporeans saw our Sunderland. I'm sorry, it wasn't for the Queen, that one. It was the Battle of Britain flypast. And we put 12 of our Sunderlands into the air and flew them over Singapore.
Can you describe to me the Sunderland, what it was like as an aircraft?
Its limitations, of course, was caused by its need to have reasonable water to fly off if the weathers were bad, and or those waters were choppy and high, then it was not advisable to take them off. So we were governed in many cases by the quality of the weather before they could be exploited properly. And of course we know this, of course, because in the Second World War, the Sunderlands used in the North Atlantic often couldn't become airborne because of weather conditions, and they had standby aircraft on other squadrons who did their sorties for them. It was a remarkably comfortable aircraft, spacious, and it was rather nice. The engineer, flight engineer, would prepare meals for us, and we had a rather nice little lounge there where we could sit and have a meal and do all the other things. In fact, one of the things we used to be pestered with was various staff people who were paying visits either to Hong Kong or to perhaps to Japan, felt that they ought to really be passengers on our flyovers, where they could sit in comfort and thing. So some we took up in the trip. So the aircraft itself was very very reliable, very reliable, very comfortable, and in a way, an aircraft you became very attached to. there were, of course, the limitations that you have to drag the aircraft out of the water to service it, and it requires fairly regular servicing. And it also meant that because of that, there weren't many places that you could actually use as a base for Sunderlands because of their requirement on the servicing side to get them out of the water. You also need, of course, a marine craft that will take the crews out to their things and generally assist when needed in the maritime matters. And we had a marine officer, RAF, on the wing, who looked after problems of that sort. And so generally, during my time with them, we didn't, as far as I recall, lose any aircraft, which seems to suggest something on those long flights and the type of work they were doing. They were a reliable old aircraft of World War II being now utilized in a different role and doing it very effectively.
What facilities did you have in Singapore for the aircraft? I'm thinking you've mentioned that it needed a certain amount of facilities. What was available in Singapore?
Well, actually, of course, we had the appropriate hangars for that type of aircraft. We also had the various types of necessary equipment of which you could tow the aircraft on wheels out of the sea. That meant bringing them in and then putting a piece of kit consisting of wheels and then having equipment to tow the aircraft out of the water take it where you wanted to take it on wheels. So, unlike the old Catalina, where you could bring it in. So that was it. I don't think.
What was the situation in Japan, though? Was that a similar situation when you went up on detachment to Japan?
Yes. We operated from a place called Iwakuni, which was in the island of the southern part of the island of Honshu, which is none too far from the Straits of Tsushima. In fact, once you got up in the air and headed northwards, you could more or less cross the straits heading up to northern Korean waters, or southern Korean waters. We were under the operational control of Americans, who were in the waters there had, I believe it was a destroyer, where the operational aspects of these flights were carried out. So we would have to visit the American briefing organization for the allocation of sorties and what exactly was expected of us. And that worked very well, except, of course, there was a serious problem to deal with, and that was that the Americans didn't have any alcoholic drinks aboard. Apart from that minor deficiency, we got on quite well with the Americans, I'm not aware that there were any difficulties about the operational aspects.
When you would do these, I'm thinking of the ones from Japan towards Korea. What were you specifically looking for?
Shipping generally. Korean shipping, either coming down from the north for some particular purpose, either to attack or sink something, or bring Korean troops and naval people down into Korea and offloading them for specific purposes, which I think they did on some occasions. And that was generally our task, to keep an eye on everything that was down there that was afloat in our area of operations.
And should you have spotted something, what was the procedure then?
Well, then of course we radioed back in cipher to our base, telling them that there was something there we hadn't been briefed on, or we were unaware of, or what should we do, and that sort of thing. I can't recall that any of our aircraft were ever attacked by the North Koreans at that stage. Because the Seoul, Sunderland flying over the seas there, it's not easy to see or meet with. But I think we did an excellent job there with the equipment that we had, aged aircraft. And in some cases, and most cases for that matter, most of the crew were World War II veterans who were more than versed with maritime operations. And so that was the sort of conduct that went on there, pretty effectively, I think.
And on any of these operations, was there ever any situations where any mass movements or movements were spotted and radioed back? Not that I'm aware of.
That doesn't really say very much, because you have to remember that the months would go by before you go back up there, and you didn't have access to all the operational briefings and debriefings. And certainly, in any case, that wasn't part of my job to do that.
Equally with the same similar type of patrols that you were doing off the coast of Malaysia, was there more of a problem there of sort of gun running, that type of thing occurring along the coast?
There had been identified problems dealing with ships, craft of different sorts heading for Malaysia and watching and coming in at night and doing things like that. Which were clearly bringing in something or other for the communists there. Ammunition and all that sort of thing was coming in. So I think we effectively picked that up and stopped it. Once again, at 1952 to 1953, we didn't seem to be engaged in the type of warfare that we played in the North Atlantic. the weather was very nice, of course, in Malaysia, and not unpleasant. And of course, the trips were very much shorter.
Was there an element that you were also looking for pirates in the area?
I can't remember we looked for pirates, but we looked for anything that we thought might be suspicious and on its heading to Malaysia. We could always send back and ask for whether they knew anything about it. And we did that.
John, can you give me as much detail, possibly, of one of the fire dog missions where you were doing ground support, how that worked and how it functioned and what you were doing in the aircraft?
Yes, it was a rather strange and surprising role to find the Sunderland of all aircraft engaged. There's no question about that. And what we were doing, on a particular sortie, being allocated a particular pinpoint target area in which the army said that there were bandits located there or holed up there or whatever it may be, or they'd been engaged in fighting them. And so we would be given a particular area of land, short and small, not quite that many big areas, but just running into maybe a couple of thousand yards. And within that area, we would bomb and strafe. You know, we were carrying, I think, something like 5,000 rounds of 303 within their front and rear guns, because the front turrets were fully manned with two 303s, as were the rear turrets with their four 303s. So, that we would then find our target area and have it located. We would then go up and down it, strafing and dropping bombs. The type of bombs we were carrying were, of course, anti-personnel bombs, and they were 20-pound bombs. And our bomb load was 116 of those. And how we dealt with that particular problem was to have the boxes of the bombs down in the bomb bay, at least in the old days, the depth charges would be up on the carrier racks, which would be wheeled out underneath the wings from inside the aircraft. Well, clearly you couldn't keep pulling bomb racks in and out, and putting half a dozen bombs on it, otherwise you'd be there till the following day. So we found that the proper answer to that was to have two people on the port and starboard side of the bomb bay, standing on a shelf, in effect, which is an integral part of the aircraft, with someone down looking after the bombs in the boxes. So they would pull a few wire out at the bottom of the bombs and hand the bomb up, and they'd throw them out the window. So you had a continuous showering of these bombs out there. And then you could see them, of course, bursting on the ground. They got no little. I wouldn't like to have been underneath them as they went off. And I believe they were very old bombs as well. I seem to, for some reason, remember them being sent out there to meet that requirement, obviously. And so I noticed that attack here, there was we dropped 116 bombs in the up and down strafing of the area. We noticed, we didn't see anything. Because if there was anybody down there when we were going up and down, they were doing other things, but they were expecting. But we saturated the area quite effectively. And that was more or less the type of things that were going on.
What was the aim? Was it to force terrorists out into an army cordon, or was it to say that this is a terrorist area, we will bomb?
I think the general idea was that we should hold them there and attack them, because they were trapped in there by the army. We didn't want to have casualties going in that type of areas with jungle and where they could be ambushed with relative ease, I suppose. And so they would suggest that the way to do it was to bomb and strafe that particular area, and then the army could move in.
The type of terrain that you were operating over, was it all jungle, or was there different types of areas?
No, it was a mixed bag, mostly jungle, and there, in fact, you could see the bombs explode on the top of the trees, which was unfortunate, because some of those trees are quite tall. And I suppose they did a lot except make a bit of noise. On other areas, surprisingly, there was open ground. And on bombing and strafing, you could just go up and down the open ground. You knew if there was anybody there, they would be hiding in something or the other. So you effectively sprayed the area until you got rid of your bombs and ammunition.
And did you get any feedback, obviously, from the ground forces of any success or that type of thing?
Well, I'm told that we provided a very effective reaction to the army calls. And I think that is probably true. The army were dug in there, having caught up with these people. And I see, in one of the sorties here, I've made a note that in the target area, it was identified that there was 60 or 70 communists trapped in that area. So it's difficult to say exactly how efficient the attacks are, because nobody ever sees generally the results of them. But you could have been very effective and broken up camps and things like that. Like so many of these things of that nature, you never quite see the effects of what you're doing. Not like sinking a U-boat.
Was there any noticeable effects in Singapore Island itself of the emergency, or was it a different atmosphere on there?
No, there was never any feeling in Singapore itself about the problems in Malaya. The great inconvenience was that, of course, you were forbidden to travel from Singapore up through Malaya. We were allowed to cross the bridge there between the island and the mainland at Johor Bahru, and that was as far as you could go. After that, you're forbidden, so there's no wandering about in cars or trains or having a day out up there. That was forbidden. And of course, the trains that came up from Singapore, they were had metal on and positioned for guns and arms and things like that. But within Singapore itself, there were no obvious signs of anything like that, except on the airfields and with the army.